We are delighted that you are here for the Tolkien edition of Theology on Tuesdays. I'm Brian, for those of you that I haven't met, and this is my friend David Rowe, who is a priest in this diocese and is a certified Tolkien expert. He has written a very popular book that is called The Proverbs of Middle Earth, that if you go on Amazon, you can order, and I would encourage you to do that because it is a terrific
book. Or you can just buy it from me.
Or you could.
And then
yes.
Jeff Bezos doesn't profit out of my genius. You know.
Yes, you can talk to David afterwards and get his contact info. But we are delighted that you're here, and we are delighted to be able to kick off the year by talking a little bit about Tolkien. But before we dive into that, I just want to say especially a word of welcome to people that are new for the first time here. And you will notice that scattered around the room, there are these little sheets. And there are a couple of things on here I want to point out. The first and most important one is on the top. That's the QR code. If there's any question that you want to ask about what we talk about or really about anything at all, you can use that QR code to submit that question. And then we will, once David and I finish talking, we will have y'all upvote the questions you like, and we will address those for a little while before we go back to eating pizza and having drinks again. Also, if you are not yet on our email list, I would encourage you to get on that, and that's the next QR code down here, so you can be informed about all of the things that are going on in the Theology on Tuesdays world. And then there are two events that are on this sheet as well. One is the Mir Anglicanism Conference. It doesn't matter if you're Anglican or not, the conference is open to anyone. But the conference theme is you are not your own gospel identity in an age of expressive individualism. And that's kind of a mouthful, but it is going to be an incredible conference. We have speakers from around the world. A lot of the top experts in the world, I'd encourage you to go on the website and check that out. If you don't have time to go to the conference, I would also encourage you to check out the worship services with the conference. One of the things that you may not know is that St. Philip's has kind of a famous music program, and we are going to do a festal service of choral evensong, which is this beautiful English liturgy. That will be on Thursday, the 22nd at 4:30. That will be an amazing time. And then we will have a festal Eucharist with orchestra and brass on Friday, the 23rd, which also is going to be amazing. And then in the realm of amazing, if you want to mark your calendar for Saturday, March the 21st, I am privileged to get to joint venture with David a little bit on the next Holy Moot. Holy Moot is a conversation about Tolkien and theology. And so we're doing this one-day conference in Charleston at the Cathedral of St. Luke and St. Paul. And our theme is going to be light and high beauty and the way that Tolkien expresses these ideas in his works. There will be, besides us, there will be presenters from around the country coming for that. It will be a great time. It's not very expensive, and it's right here in Charleston.
Internationally, so as well. We have one speaker who can't fly in because she's from Spain.
Okay.
But she, yeah. I can't tell you all the details because it would spoil everything. But
okay.
The combination of art, beauty, and theology has just sparked off some fantastic proposed presentations. And so, yeah, I'm, you know, in my slightly geeky way, just salivating at the thought of March 21st. So come and drool at the thought with me.
It's going to be great. So we're looking forward to that. And tonight, what we wanted to do was to talk a little bit about what is it about Tolkien? Because you probably, if you've been coming to Theology on Tuesdays, you've heard Justin and me talk a fair amount about Tolkien. We might both be sort of obsessed with Tolkien. But part of what is interesting is it's not just us. You know, Tolkien is someone who is remarkable in terms of his popularity. And one of the things that is really intriguing is that the movies franchise has still won more awards than any other group of movies ever, and yet there is no sex, there's hardly any romance, there's no profanity, there's none of sort of the usual stuff in the movies, but people are drawn to them. And in case you've been under a rock somewhere, there is a re-release of those movies that's coming out in theaters in about a week and a half. And so keep your eye open for that because it's a great opportunity. They're going to have all the extended versions of The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and The Return of the King on the big screen, which is, if you're like me, just amazing to even contemplate that that's going to happen. But part of what is interesting about this is that Tolkien was writing a long time ago, and he was, before The Lord of the Rings, a fairly obscure and kind of nerdy professor of Anglo-Saxon, which is perhaps not something that would lead you to think someone would achieve worldwide acclaim and fame. But one of the things that is interesting about Tolkien is that he was someone whose creative work was really deeply informed by his Christian faith. Tolkien was devout in his Christian faith from a young age, and one of the things that was really important to him was building his life around the truths of Christianity. And he also was a great intellectual, and he thought anyone who was really smart, who investigated the claims of Christianity, ought to convert. And so when he met C.S. Lewis, who, when they first met, Lewis was an evangelical atheist. When he met Lewis, he was like, this guy is too smart to be an atheist. And so Tolkien started working on him, and largely through Tolkien's influence, C.S. Lewis converted to Christianity. And I want to just plug, in addition to David's book, this book, which is called Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship. This is an amazing book, not only about how the two of them interacted, but just about friendship in general, that I would highly commend to you. So what we want to do tonight is to talk a little bit about why we love Tolkien, what Tolkien has to do with Christianity, and why learning more and reading more about him might enrich your spiritual life. So David, how did you first get involved with Tolkien?
Thank you for asking. That's a very wide-ranging possible. I could answer in so many different ways. The easiest answer is that I was raised in a very good family, and so I was introduced to Tolkien on long car journeys through radio dramatization. I grew up in England, and because none of my family lived. None of our extended family lived anywhere near us. We would drive a long way quite routinely. And so I grew up listening to, amongst other things, there's a BBC radio dramatization of The Lord of the Rings, which was made in about 1980 and happened to be being broadcast even on the day I was born, I believe. and so I grew up listening to the story. And so I started reading Lord of the Rings when I was 7 because it was already normal for me. Like, I already knew it. And I knew how to pronounce the names, and I wasn't intimidated by it. So my first read through, and you know, like, this is a ridiculously large book. And there are so many bits of it that you're just looking at it going, I don't even know what the heck's going on here. and so my first read through, I know that I must have skipped quite a few times, but I was 7, and I basically haven't stopped reading Tolkien since then. Like, one way or the other, I'm always dipping in and out, but whereas other books you tend to start at the beginning and read through to the end, and then you stop, I tend to read Tolkien more like you read, like, scripture, like where you read a passage at a time and you reflect upon it. That's kind of become my way of reading it, which is, so I say that Tolkien, like, Lord of the Rings is my apocrypha. Like, that's my way of relating. Like, so I just haven't stopped. And what I found is that in not stopping, you find that every time you dive in, there's another deeper bit. And then there's another deeper bit. and there's another deeper bit. So it started a long time ago, so I'm going to guess 1986, 1987, and it's not stopped yet.
That's a beautiful thing. Well, I started about the same time as you, although it was some years earlier than yours, and read The Hobbit for the first time when I was around 7 and was entranced by it, and then went on to read The Fellowship of the Ring. And then when I read The Fellowship of the Ring, it was probably 9, and I had two experiences simultaneously. First, I decided I wanted to leave Charleston and move to Lothlorien, because I read Tolkien's description of Lothlorien, and I thought, that is the most beautiful, incredible sounding place I've ever heard of. And then I simultaneously fell in love with Galadriel. And so I was going to move to Lothlorien and marry Galadriel. I don't know what I was going to do with Celeborn, but I was not a priest at that time, so I didn't have to worry about these things.
Can I add something about that?
Sure.
My house growing up was called Lothlorien. And I asked my dad.
You're so much cooler than I am.
It wasn't my choice. I asked my dad why, because I was more of a Shire person. And he was like, because no evil can come in.
Yes.
And that's and then I just had a proposal for Holymoot last week from a lady who wants to talk about the theological implications of Galadriel's hair. Just so you know that it goes quite deep.
Yeah.
Yes, it goes very deep.
But one of the other things that is interesting to me is I feel like that my appreciation for these books and for the movies has just only grown as I've gotten older. And I give Tolkien a lot of credit for getting me through law school, because law school, as you may have heard, is a very stressful experience. And what I would do in law school is I would study and study and study for exams, because in law school, your final exam is your only grade for the course. There's no other grade. There's no other test. There's no other anything. It was very stressful. So I'd study, but then 2 weeks before the exams, I would stop studying, and I would start reading The Lord of the Rings again. And I would read The Lord of the Rings, the whole thing, through exams. And it was so great. And part of the reason that that worked is that, as David was saying, The Lord of the Rings is a really deep work, and it has layer after layer after layer after layer. And part of it is a really complete world. And it is a world that has history. It is a world that has trauma. It is a world that has beauty. It is a world that has longing. It is a world that has spiritual truth. It has all of these things. And in the middle of it, the thing that you see, I think, perhaps the most, and one of the things that has always drawn me to Tolkien, is there is this beautiful theology of friendship in these books, where there are these incredible friendships that happen all through the book among different kinds of people and different races of people, where there is brokenness and hurt, but also beauty and joy and all of that just sort of all together. And I think that part of why the books and the movies resonate with people is that you are able to enter into this other world. And our world so often feels like it is tilting off its axis. But when you enter into the world that Tolkien creates, there's good and evil, and there's beauty, and there's purpose and meaning, but there are bad things that are happening, but there are good people that are working to try to end the evil and to bring the good to fruition. And Tolkien does such a beautiful job of not sugarcoating anything. You know, in these stories, people that you care about deeply in the story die. But yet you see that their life wasn't meaningless. And you just keep pushing through and seeing the more and more depth that occurs. And part of what is beautiful about this is that you see Tolkien taking a lot of the ideas that he learned from his Christian faith as a Catholic, particularly ideas about virtues and ideas about what the scriptures call us to. And instead of teaching us about them didactically, he shows them to us in the way that these characters relate with each other. Mm-hmm. So it is a beautiful thing. I was talking to someone earlier tonight who had watched The Tolkien biopic that came out a couple of years ago, there were some really good things in that biopic. My favorite thing about it was that it showed the depth of Tolkien's deep friendships that he had when he was in middle school and high school with something called the TCBS, the Tea Club and Barovian Society, where he had these friends and they would share poetry with each other and they were so deeply bonded, and then they all died just about in World War I. And Tolkien lived with that wound and that gap in his life for the rest of his life. And the movie, I think, got that right. But the thing the movie really missed was that the whole organizing principle of Tolkien's life was his Christian faith, and particularly his Catholic Christian faith. And they just sort of left that out, which would be like doing a biopic on Tiger Woods and leaving out golf. So they kind of missed the boat on that. But there's still some good things about it. Mm-hmm. So, David, what would you say are some of your favorite works of Tolkien?
Works.
Because there, one of the things you might not have known is Tolkien did not write just The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. He also wrote other things.
Yeah, no, you're asking for trouble now because... because there's a lot...
I'm all about trouble. Go for it.
There's a lot of really intriguing stuff that you can get into if, you know, you really want to dive deeper.
If you're brave.
One of my favorite stories is a story called Leif by Niggle, which is a short story about a man who has one thing in his life, one thing he cares for, and it's a painting of a tree. And it describes Niggle as the kind of painter who is better at drawing leaves than trees. And so this tree, as he's painting it, grows and it gets bigger and bigger, and he keeps on having to tack on more canvas round and round the end. But all the time while he's painting it, in the back of his mind, he knows that his time is short because he has a journey to go on. And it's the only story that Tolkien wrote which has an allegorical kind of feel to it, where Niggle is effectively him working on this great unfinishable creative act that he's utterly in love with, but at the same time is never quite as beautiful as the one he sees in his mind. And at the same time, he knows his time is short and he has a journey, i.e. he's going to die. He has a journey to go on. And the beautiful sort of, should I spoil the story? I don't know.
No.
Okay. I won't do that.
Leave them hanging.
At the end of the story, after the bit that I'm not going to spoil, there's two people who come across a single leaf from that painting. And they're just looking at it going, oh, I remember Niggle. Yes, whatever became of him. And I think it's really interesting as a creator, as a writer, as somebody who poured his life into this great creative project, this sort of quasi-mythology, he also didn't expect to be remembered. Mm-hmm. He expected that this thing that he was giving his life to was basically a kind of private hobby. And so he wrote Leif by Niggle far before he was famous. And the intriguing thing about it is that when you read it as him, you recognize, I don't know how many people here are artists or creatives, but he's describing the integrity of the artistic process, that it does not matter if anybody else appreciates you or you become famous or you have any influence over anyone else, that your purpose in life is to create. And you will never be entirely fulfilled until you fulfill some of that creative role that you've been given.
Yes.
Even if nobody else ever even notices.
That's right.
And I think that's just an astonishing thing to think about, that, like, you know, all the different ways that we might create, like some people create by making meals, some people create by building boats. You know what I mean? There's so many forms of creativity, and it's not about the applause. It's about being a creator, that we're all made to be creators.
Yes, and that is a great lead-in to one of my favorite works by Tolkien that most people have never heard of, that is called, depending on which person you listen to, it could be Mythopoeia, it is a poem that Tolkien wrote for C.S. Lewis after the conversation that led to Lewis's conversion. And it's about a 4-page long poem, so it's not short, but it is glorious. And it sort of is a dialogue between the atheistic, materialistic point of view and the Christian, richly textured, full of joy and beauty and purpose perspective that Tolkien had. And one of the things that he talks about in that poem that he and Lewis then developed a whole theology around is this idea of sub-creation, and that what it means to be made in the image of God, which was one of Tolkien's major theological things he loved to talk about, that we are made in the image of God, and that is a hugely beautiful thing, that humans are the only people, well, the only part of creation, who then can create themselves. And so he would call that sub-creation. And he would say that we are never more leaning into our God-given identity than when we are creating in some way, whether it be a beautiful meal or a story or a song or whatever it might be, and that is something that God has built into us and desires for us to use. And the poem has this beautiful stanza about sub-creation. Oh, yeah?
If you'd like me to read it, I've got...
Don't read the whole poem.
But that stanza you're talking about?
Yeah, read that poem. Man, sub-creator.
Okay? Yeah. The heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise, and still recalls him, though now long estranged. Man is not wholly lost, nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned, his world dominion by creative act, not his to worship the great artifact. Man, sub-creator, the refracted light, through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind to mind. I could go on.
Yes, it's so good. But that whole idea of sub-creation is throughout Lewis and Tolkien's work, and that is what inspired them to create these worlds. So whether it's the world of Narnia, or whether it's the world of Middle Earth, or whether it is what Lewis did in the space, the Ransom trilogy, out of the silent planet, Perelandra, that hideous strength, all those things are inspired by this doctrine of sub-creation. But one of the other things that I love in Tolkien's work is the way that he shows you what true friendship really is like. And I think that's one of the reasons that particularly while we're in this crisis of loneliness in our culture and people are so addicted to devices and social media instead of real face-to-face, look-in-the-eye, loving friendships, that when you read Tolkien, there's a magnetic attraction there. And I want to just read this one excerpt, if I can find it, that is from The Fellowship of the Ring. And it is when, if you've read the story, Sam and Frodo are trying to leave the Shire because they need to escape before the Dark Lord knows that they have the ring. But Merry and Pippin, their other friends, find out about it and tell them that they're joining them. And so we have this little dialogue. Frodo says, "It does not seem I can trust anyone," because he thought all of this was secret. Sam looked at him unhappily. "It all depends on what you want," put in his friend Merry. "You can trust us to stick to you through thick and thin, to the bitter end, and you can trust us to keep any secret of yours closer than you keep it yourself. But you cannot trust us to let you face trouble alone and go off without a word. We are your friends, Frodo. Anyway, there it is. We know most of what Gandalf has told you. We know a good deal about the ring. We are horribly afraid, but we are coming with you or following you like hounds." And that is just a beautiful, beautiful thing, that they are terrified, they don't really understand, but they know that the demand of friendship is that they not abandon their friend and leave him alone to face this peril. So there is great beauty in that.
Yeah.
So if you have a favorite passage out of The Lord of the Rings, what might that be?
Oh my, could I say something about friendship very quickly
first?
When I was in college, I had a very distinct moment. I think it was my second year of college. I felt lonely. I do my best thinking when I'm out walking. So I was going walking, and it just clicked into my mind, whether it's like God speaking or me speaking or whatever else, it clicked into my mind, you need a Sam. You need a Sam. And so I started literally praying that God would give me a Sam, i.e. that in the quest of my life, obviously everyone is Frodo in the quest of their own lives, but everyone needs a Sam. You have to have a Sam. And so I started praying for a Sam, and then I got one. And it was just so, so cool to go from that position of feeling like I was on this thing on my own to having someone who I was shoulder to shoulder with. It means the world. And so, like, yeah, you need a Sam, guys.
All right, I don't want to get preachy, I have to throw in something about that before you get to what you love passage-wise. But there's this wonderful scene at the end of The Fellowship of the Ring where Frodo has decided that he needs to go off on his own to try to fulfill this quest because it's too dangerous for everyone else. And so he's going to leave Sam behind. And so Frodo's trying to escape, but Sam catches him trying to escape. And Frodo says, no, Sam, you have to stay here. I must go to Mordor alone. And Sam says, of course you must, and I'm coming with you. And he refuses to be daunted. And Frodo's trying to take the boat away. And Sam, who can't swim, swims out. And Frodo ends up having to rescue him and pull him into the boat. But it is that type of deep, unbreakable loyalty that you see in that friendship.
So a passage that means a lot to me, am I speaking to muggles here, or do you generally know the story?
Some people do.
So there's a point in the story where Sam and Frodo have been separated. Frodo has been captured. He is in a tower held by orcs, and Sam can't get in. And he has no other purpose in life other than to serve his master. And he doesn't know what to do. And the light, there's like a torchlight in the place he is, and it sputters and goes out. And it says the darkness flowed over him like a wave. And it describes that point where you're at your absolute lowest. And there is a beautiful description that says, there at the end of a long road, I can't do justice to the words from memory. It just says, and Sam began to sing. And he sings this song. I'm going to take a risk and sing a little bit of it.
All right, go for it.
In western lands beneath the sun, the flowers may rise in spring. The sea, the trees may bud, the waters run, the merry finches sing. Or there may be 'tis cloudless night and swaying beaches bare, the elven stars as jewels white amid their branching hair. Now here at journey's end I lie in darkness buried deep, beyond all towers strong and high, beyond all mountains steep. Above all shadows rides the sun, and stars forever dwell. I will not say the day is done, nor bid the stars farewell. And he is at the point, I have felt myself at a similar point on several occasions. And when you're in that, when the darkness just flows over you, metaphorically or in reality, to have a song that I could sing is incredible. And just to say, I will not say the day is done or bid the stars farewell. Like, it's like this moment of defiance when you're just at your most crumpled on the floor, when you just have to get yourself up again and say, no.
Yeah.
And I need to sing. And I feel like it's one of these really peculiar little images that I love. But I once, I'm an insomniac. I sleep incredibly badly, which means I often go for a walk before it gets light in the morning. And the thing is that the birds are already singing before the sun comes up. And I think that's incredible. That in anticipation of darkness turning to light, they're already singing. And so I feel for me that passage speaks to me about when you're in that place and you don't know if the light is coming back, you start singing and you sing until it does.
Yes. And there are so many instances of things like that in that story, which is one of the things that is so incredibly beautiful about it. And one of the things that you see, the more that you learn about Tolkien, is that he lived that way. He had moments in his life of deep darkness, but he refused to let the darkness overwhelm him. And he always had this deep commitment to friendship and also a deep commitment to fun. His father, Christmas Letters, if you've never seen those, Tolkien was an amazing artist. He could have been just a visual artist with his painting without ever writing anything and could have been famous. But what you see in his father, Christmas Letters, is his creativity. One of the stories I love about him and Lewis is they were invited to a fancy dress party in Oxford and they went dressed as polar bears. You know, who does that? That's great. I want to just read this one thing before we go to questions that is talking about the idea of joy. Joy is something that is hugely important to Tolkien. And Tolkien made up a word that, if you're a nerd like I am, you may have heard of, that he made up that's called eucatastrophe. Most of us know the word catastrophe when like the worst has happened. A eucatastrophe is when a joyous, unexpected thing happens and comes in and totally turns everything upside down. So let me just read this and then we'll go to questions. This joy, which I've selected as the mark of the true story, merits more consideration. Probably every writer making a secondary world, that is a subcreation, wishes to be a real maker or hopes he's drawing on reality, hopes that the peculiar quality of this subcreation world is derived from reality or flowing into it. The peculiar quality of the joy in these kinds of stories can be explained as a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality of truth. It is not only a consolation for the sorrow of this world, but a satisfaction. And an answer to that question, is it true? The answer to this question that I gave at first was, if you built your little world well, yes, it's true in that world. That's enough for the artist. But in the eucatastrophe, we see in a brief vision that the answer may be greater. It may be a far-off gleam or echo of the gospel in the real world. I would venture to say that approaching the Christian story from this direction, it's long been my joyous feeling that the gospel stories contain a story of a larger kind that embraces all the essence of stories. They contain many marvels, peculiarly artistic, beautiful, and moving, mythical in their perfect consistency. And among the marvels is the greatest and most complete conceivable eucatastrophe. And then there's a little bit more.
Might be that one.
Thank you.
Sorry, I stole it.
But this story entered history in the primary world and has been raised to the fulfillment of creation. The birth of Jesus Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. The joy would have the same quality, if not the same degree, as the joy which the turn in a fairy story gives. Such joy has the very taste of truth. Otherwise, its name would not be joy. It looks forward or backward to the great eucatastrophe. The Christian joy, the gloria, is of the same kind. It is high and joyous, but the gospel story is supreme, and it is true. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. The gospel has not abrogated legends. It has hallowed them. The story is supreme, and it is true. So, On that note, if you want to submit some questions, Wes, if you're around, we would love to give you a microphone and let you help us with that.
Hello, hello, hello. This is working. We have some questions, and I'm just going to go ahead and start if you guys are ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of all over the place tonight, so.
Great.
It's all good.
With what is happening in the world in Venezuela, Iran, and Minnesota, how can Tolkien help to relate and help us learn more about our own society?
That is an excellent question. So I would say one of the things that is so particularly helpful about Tolkien is that in his works, you see all of the darkness. You see the evil, you see betrayal, you see good people who have gone over to the dark side. You see all of that, and yet in the midst of that, you see that hope endures. And one of the beautiful scenes in the story is when Gandalf is talking with Galadriel. And sorry if you don't know the story, you should go read the book and then you will. When Gandalf is talking to Galadriel and they're talking about how everything is going wrong in the world and about how Saruman, particularly, who was a good wizard, has gone over to the dark side and they're lamenting that. And Galadriel is saying, you know, we need someone powerful to do something. And Gandalf comes back with one of the most beautiful quotations in the series, where he says, some people believe that it is by great power that the world has changed and that the darkness is set back, but that is not what I have found. What I have found that it is the good and loving deeds of small and ordinary folk that change the course of the world. And I think that is a great lesson for us. Instead of getting all worked up about all of these things that we can't control, that choosing to be loving and kind in the sphere in which God has placed us and with the relationships that we have can be really meaningful.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I spent half of your time thinking about it. The thing that comes to mind is when Alexander Solzhenitsyn talks about, wouldn't it be great if we just had all the good people over mm-hmm. here and all the bad people over there, and that would be so clear. But he says but the line between good and evil doesn't go between nations, it goes through the human heart. And so every single one of us is both on the side of good and on the side of evil. And Tolkien does a great job of, rather than saying it, showing it.
Yep.
And so every single one of his characters, whether a good character or a bad character, is not wholly good or bad. The good characters do sometimes dumb things, but also evil things. And the bad characters genuinely have
moments.
Like even you overhear orcs talking about, wouldn't it be nice if we, and they start reminiscing about the good old days. And it's like, these are orcs, they're supposed to be the evil ones that we hate, but no. He humanizes even the ones that are on the side of evil. And I think that that's a really helpful thing to apply sort of geopolitically, that rather than thinking in those stark black and white terms, we recognize that evil is in our own hearts as well as everywhere else, but also that good is in our own hearts mm-hmm. as well as everywhere else.
Yeah.
Are we, as people, predestined? If so, how do we accept free will with the understanding that what we've done was already supposed to happen?
Okay, well, that is a question that we could spend probably the next millennium answering. But I would say a couple of things about that part of what is helpful that Tolkien and Lewis both bring to the table for us is what I would call an eternal perspective. And that part of the understanding of the eternal perspective is that God is outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are creatures that are in time. Some of y'all have heard me talk before about Flat Stanley. You're probably too young to know about Flat Stanley. But when I was in elementary school, every year at the end of the semester before summer vacation, Flat Stanley would come out, and Flat Stanley was made on the mimeograph machine in the teacher workroom, and then he was laminated, and it was a little flat paper doll named Stanley. And you would be given a flat Stanley, and then your job over the summer was to take flat Stanley with you when you went on vacation, and then take a Polaroid picture, which was what you did back then, of where you were with flat Stanley. And flat Stanley might have gone with you to Disney World or Niagara Falls or whatever it was. He was there, but he experienced it in a completely different way than you did. So I think part of the issue with this whole free will and predestination is that we don't understand how both of those can be true at the same time, because we are stuck within time. God is outside of time and can see that all God lives in an eternal present. If you want to expand your mind about this, read Lewis's chapter about this in Mere Christianity. It's really good. But I think the idea is that God does give us free will, but because God can see sort of above everything, he knows which direction we are going to end up going. And that doesn't diminish free will, that he has that knowledge. But that I think part of what it means is that it's important for us to lean into what we believe God is calling us to do, that we seek after truth, we seek to do what is right, and we seek after what we believe is his calling on our life.
Yeah, I'm not going to say a whole lot about that. The thing, it is like, you know, that's a three-pipe problem. I think the only thing I'd add is the thing that confuses us is that because so often we act in order to get the right results, we're sort of consequentialists. We do this in order that we do that, that would happen. We do this in order that happen. And God doesn't function like that. He does things because he's faithful to who he is. He doesn't forgive us because we're going to live out his forgiveness.
Right.
He forgives us because we repent and turn to him. And so that's one of the things that's very difficult for us to get our heads around when we start thinking about whether the future has already been planned. Because God is eternally himself, he will always be entirely faithful to who he is. So the way he treats you now is completely faithful to his character, and not just based on who you're going to turn into tomorrow and the next day and the day after that.
Yeah, and Tolkien is actually really good on this, because when you read in the stories, for example, in The Lord of the Rings, there are things that happen that are inexplicable. So, for example, when he talks about how the ring came to Frodo, so there's an aspect of providence and predestination in Tolkien, but there also very clearly is free will. So. Both at the same time.
How do we break out of life feeling cyclical, mundane, or lacking direction and inject motivation and purpose back into our lives?
That is a great question. I think if we could come up with a short and simple answer to that, we would all be rich. But I think one part of that is leaning into filling your heart and mind with things that are full of beauty, truth, and goodness. Because I think that part of the reason that we get so worn down and feeling stuck and don't feel like that we're living a life that has meaning or purpose or beauty is that everything that's coming into our hearts and our minds from media or social media or whatever it might be is filling us with angst. And part of what, and this is a rabbit trail that I won't go all the way down, but a little bit of the way down, there's a great work by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man. And what he talks about in that is that we so often in our culture today have not been trained to love what is beautiful, true, and good. And so our hearts pursue the wrong things, and then we don't understand why they're not fulfilling. And what Lewis is saying is that when we lean into what God has said in Scripture and what God has proclaimed through creation is beautiful, true, and good, that makes for our flourishing. So I would say if you feel like you're sort of stuck in that wrong side of that equation, one of the best things you can do is look at what are you listening to, what are you reading, what are you paying attention to, where are you in your relationship with God, are you spending time in worship, all of those things, because I think when you set your heart and your mind and your eyes and your thoughts after the things that are true, good, and beautiful, that problem begins to solve itself.
I can't remember the whole question, but the word purpose jumped out at me. So something about purpose. Brian and I are both ordained priests. Before you can be ordained, you go through something called a discernment process, where along with other people, you seek to find out, is this person called to this role as an ordained minister? The thing that bugs the heck out of me is, why don't we do that for everyone? Why don't we get together with the people who know and love us best and are committed to us and spend time discerning, what is this person made for? What are we called to? Because there is such a borderline nihilistic result if you don't have a reason to exist. And not just sort of a general reason to exist. And I think the scriptural principles you're talking about are incredibly foundational, like we are all made to love God and to love our neighbor. We are all, you know, those things that apply to all of us. But there are also things that you as an individual have been created for that nobody else has been created for. And we just don't dive into the possibility that we could know that. And I would really love it if, I mean, anyone had a real go at doing that. The church in general, or even just small groups of friends together. Because like looking back in retrospect on my life, you could have probably worked out what I was meant. I'm a school chaplain. I've spent my whole life either doing church work or with kids. Someone could have pointed that out to me like 20 years earlier, and it would have made my years of being unemployed and confused and depressed so different.
Yes. Yes, and I will put in a plug here for having a mentor can be a great way to help that. If you do not have a mentor, think about who in your life is an older person who is a Christian, who is perhaps wiser than you are, and just go to them and say, I would love to spend more time with you. Because I think often when you have someone like that in your life who can speak into those things that are your gifts, that can encourage you to take the risk to live into what your calling may be.
And especially when things are not working out, to have someone who is actually going to be like, I'm still with you.
Right, and who believes in you.
And I'm going to stay with you, because that's what I have. I have a mentor who, when I was really, really struggling, was still there meeting with me and being, and it's just to hear somebody else's voice saying, it's not the end. This is, you still have a purpose. Let's go there.
Yeah, for sure.
I know that God created work as a good thing, but so often at work, I can't make myself believe that and desire to work and please God.
That ties quite in with what we were previously saying about purpose, because what I've discovered, and you probably know this from experience, if you know why you're doing something, you can go through almost anything, right? But if there's no reason to go through it, even the most just a boring day can feel like torture.
Yes.
And so purpose and a sense of calling really makes a huge difference to your understanding of work, because work becomes a means by which not just, well, I have to because I have to do this in order that I pay for this and I have it, but actually I have been made for a real purpose, which the world would be less if I didn't fulfill it.
This. Yes.
And therefore, my work can and should and must be a part of that. It isn't that every single time the thing that you're paid to do is the thing that you're called to do to make a difference in the world. Sometimes it's a means to an end or a period you're going through. But you can go through almost anything if you know why.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I would say there's an excellent book. If you're struggling with that issue, there's an excellent book by Tim Keller that I'm blanking on the name of right now that's about work. If you Google Tim Keller book on work, it'll come up. But that can be very helpful. And I think one of the things that is so hard in our culture right now, and this is something I can see because I'm an old person, is that there's been this shift in culture just during my lifetime where everything that you hear throughout your educational experience is that what you want to do, you might not know it, but what you want to do is to do the thing that makes you the most money. Because if you do that, then you're going to be happy. And that is a lie. And the problem is that our culture is built so much around that principle. And it's very scary to try to break out of that and think, maybe I'm called to do something that isn't the thing that makes the most money. And I'm sort of the poster child for that. I mean, I used to make a fortune when I was a lawyer, but I'm so eternally thankful to God that I'm not still doing that. There's so much more about meaning and purpose than just how much money you're making.
Yeah.
All right, one or two more.
Could that book have been Every Good Endeavor?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sweet.
Good job.
What does the ring represent?
There have been so many things written about what the ring represents. And I still remember when I first was reading The Lord of the Rings, I think it was back in the 1970s probably, everything that you would read would say that the ring was about nuclear something, and the end of the world and nuclear power and all that, which is ridiculous because when Tolkien started writing it, that wasn't even like
didn't exist.
A thing.
Hadn't been invented.
Yeah. Yet. But that didn't stop people from appropriating the book. So you can find people that will give you 30 different answers for that question. But I think that part of what Tolkien is trying to get at with the idea of the ring is that anything that you elevate to the level of an idol can become the ring in your own life. And that whenever we think that sort of thing, particularly sinful desires, when we believe that we can control those and we are sort of the master of our destiny, that is when we are in really deep trouble. And I think part of what the ring tells us is that sin has to be destroyed and that we can't master it on our own, and the only thing that we can do is to cling to Jesus and to his sacrifice. But I would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, on one level, the ring doesn't represent anything. It is the ring. That's what it is. And Tolkien was very wary about people trying to read allegories into his stories. But on the other hand, it is so applicable because it shows us the effect of power on people. Like, if you have the ability to, for example, make any other person do what you want them to do, what would you want them to do? Because, like, you see, Sam has this wonderful vision of what he would do if he had the ring, which he'd basically turn everything into a garden. And Boromir has a vision of what he would do if he had the ring, which would be he would be the captain of the greatest army in history and overthrow
Galadriel.
And Galadriel has a vision. They all have these little visions of what would I do if I had basically unlimited power. And it shows us just how terrifyingly messed up we are. That like
how vulnerable
if
we are.
If any of us had unlimited power, God help the rest of us. You know? And so I think that's one of the things that it shows us, that even Sam is the least corruptible character in all of it, and he is still having these great visions of grandeur.
Yeah.
And so that's the danger that power has. And it also, the second side of the ring is it always isolates you from other people.
Yeah.
Everyone who desires the ring desires it for themselves, not for us, but for me.
Yeah.
And The effect of evil in Tolkien's world generally, but in Lord of the Rings in particular, is that people who fall into evil distrust everybody else, and they cease to be able to work with other people, and so it destroys that capacity for friendship and communal joy and working together, that kind of collaborative goodness.
Yeah. And there are such interesting things in Tolkien's dating in the book. March 25th is a really important date where the ring is destroyed, which corresponds in the medieval cosmology that Tolkien was a big fan of. March 25th was the date that Jesus was crucified. So, you know, there's all of this sort of backroom synergy going on with the Christian faith with that. Right, let's do one more.
Okay. How do you handle unhealthy family relationships? Balancing compassion and honoring parents while breaking cycles of abuse and protecting your peace.
Okay, that is a great and very real question that I think a lot of people are dealing with. And I would say, and this is not a cop-out, I would say it depends. Because every family is dysfunctional in its own unique way. And so I would be hesitant to offer a prescription of one size fits all. But I do think that one of the ways that you begin to do that is to spend some time, if you're a Christian, spend some time with 1 Corinthians 13 and some time with Romans 12, thinking about what does it actually mean to love? Because I think that we have a lot of misbegotten notions in our culture about love. And what you see, and part of what I love about Scripture is that it's so real. When you look in 1 Corinthians 13 and Romans 12, it is all about actions that you take. It's not about your feelings. Mm-hmm. It's all about actions that you take. And you can't control what your family is going to do. You can't control the way your family is going to respond. But you can control what you do. And so I think for us as Christians, the one thing I would be comfortable saying sort of generally is that if you do the things that are commended in 1 Corinthians 13 and Romans 12, the idea of love is patient, love is kind, love does not seek its own way, love keeps no record of wrongs, those kinds of things. Romans 12, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, hate what is evil, cling to what is good. All of those things can help you in those kind of circumstances.
I'm going to attempt a Lord of the Rings answer.
All right, go for it.
Partly because I'm working with someone at the moment who's in this precise situation, and I don't have a good answer because it's an incredibly difficult one. But the thing that I want to, is being in that situation of how do I love people who are damaging me? I don't have a solution to how you should act, but I do believe whatever you choose to do, you need to always leave the door open for redemption. And redemption is when God takes something that has gone wrong and turns it to what is better than if nothing had gone wrong. And I...
Like a catastrophe. Yeah.
I am a huge believer that one of the things, one of the number one things that I adore about the gospel is that it is not just good things happening all the way through, that there are terrible things that are turned to good. And so leaving the door open for the possibility of redemption, of things that have been awful, still having the scope for turning to good. And this is, ironically perhaps, but this is something that happens all the way through Lord of the Rings. Even the worst characters are given the opportunity. They're not rejected forever, but there is still, Gandalf especially holds out the hope mm-hmm. that even their enemies could change.
Yes.
Even their enemies could turn. And he says, and he uses the word pity, which we find like a condescending word, but it means to want the best for somebody else who's in a bad situation. He says, I pity even the Sauron slaves. And so when you're in that situation, I believe in redemption. I even believe in resurrection, that when something is dead, It can still come back to life. So I'm a school chaplain. I had a second grader come up to me today, and she looked at me from across the playground. This was at recess this morning. She looked at me from across the playground, and I knew she wanted to talk to me. So I walked towards her as she would talk. It was one of those ones. And I said hi, and she said hi, and I was like, so what is it? And she was like, my parents have got back together again. And I know the story because I know what's going on. And it's a story of when things have gone wrong and the people in the story have chosen to not give up, but actually said, we've completely screwed this up. Is there still hope? And there was still hope.
Yeah.
And there really was. And they weren't doing it in a, like, in a sort of like eyes wide shut way. They weren't just hoping beyond hope. They did it slowly and sensibly. And now this little girl is like, my mommy and my daddy are back together again. And she was glowing.
Yeah.
And so I really, like, even though the world is full of dreadful pain and tears that may not be wiped away until the world itself is gone, there is still the scope for redemption and for resurrection in any situation.
Yeah. And I want to just close by saying, I brought this with me. If you've read the stories, this is my model white tree of Gondor. And one of the things that you see in The Lord of the Rings is this idea of hope that permeates the stories. And the idea of the white tree of Gondor is that it blossoms and flourishes when the king is coming back. And so the tree is planted in the city of Gondor, and it is dead. It is dead, dead, dead. There are no leaves, there are no flowers, there are no anything. And then all of the sudden, without anyone doing anything, something changes, and all of a sudden, a bud and a flower comes on it. And that, I think, is the way that hope works, that so often when we are at the end of our resources and in darkness and without any hope, God intervenes in some way and hope begins to be born. So thank you so much for being here tonight. We're grateful that y'all came, and we look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. And let's thank David for joining us tonight.